This is Lynn Dierking, live from Corvallis, Oregon. I'm looking out of my kitchen window, and it is a beautiful, beautiful day. It's beginning to feel like spring here. We've seen insects and birds and all sorts of stuff out and about, and the trees are budding. We have three people, I'm one of them, with us this afternoon. Lena Hosking, who's our GTA for the court, SED 583. And then we also have Michelle Milam, who's our certificate GTA. And then our very special guest, Dr. Scott Pattison. But I wanted first to do a couple of things. I wanted to say welcome to Module 3. Hopefully you're getting the sense that as we're moving through the course, we started very generally and just kind of dumped you into the sociocultural world, trying to gather some vocabulary and some ideas of what are the major ideas. Last module, we really started to think about what culture is. And I know some of you are still saying, well, what is that thing called culture? And I really recommend rereading the John Ogbu article, which does a very, very good job, I think, of really defining what culture is. You know, and he talks about the roles, the traditions, the patterns of behavior that people engage in and their relationship with institutions. He says it a little more succinctly than me, and there's a really nice place where he lays it out. I will send out a note after the radio show reminding you what page I would recommend you read. But anyway, we talked about culture and started thinking about norms and behavior. Now we're moving into another aspect of the sociocultural dimensions of free choice learning by talking about social stratification, looking at issues like gender, I would say age, also race, ethnicity, certainly class, and how those social stratifications influence, again, our behavior and the norms that we feel we can exercise in particular settings. And we also start talking about this word called agency, which is basically this notion of people being able to actively take action and do things for themselves. And we'll be talking about the fact that depending upon social stratification, sometimes individuals, but often also groups of people, may feel in certain circumstances that they have more or less agency. And so that's something that we'll be beginning to explore. At any rate, I think it's a really fascinating module. We've got some great readings. We start talking about things like science identity and think about that in relationship to gender and class. We're also going to be thinking about how do free choice learning settings, and I would say also settings like schools, to what degree do these settings offer agency to learners? So those are some of the ideas that we're going to focus on. I know that all of you maybe have not turned in your module 2 assignment yet, which for my class is due at midnight. I'm not sure when Michelle's is due for the certificate group, but I do want to take this opportunity really quickly to talk about the final project. I know, and I just want to recognize again that this course is quite a difficult course. We have a lot of readings that are very tough at times. We have these weekly assignments, and then you get to do a final project as well. I want to recognize and acknowledge that that's a lot to keep on one plate. Ideally, though, it is not too soon, and you'll see laid out in a final project timeline that's posted into the Module 3, that it's not too soon to begin thinking about and designing your final project. And cleverly, it could build on the assignment that you just completed if you enjoyed the setting in which you did your work. And even though we give you a very specific video to look at for this week's assignment, for this module's assignment, we start doing more detailed analysis, and we begin really looking for patterns of behavior and themes that we might be able to call out. And so this assignment also will help hone your skills for the next for this final project. I will give you a hint that in Module 4, the assignment actually is a write-up of what you plan to do for your final project. So after this assignment and this module, you will really begin to focus in on your final project. But anyway, just very quickly, I laid out a final project timeline. We are in week 5, believe it or not, of this course, and we're beginning Module 3. And this week, as you're balancing readings and thinking about the assignment that you have, really want you to decide where are you going to do your study. Where do you want to do an observational study? As I said, it can be exactly the place that you did this past module's assignment. It certainly can be your workplace. If you want to try another place in your community, but by all means, you want to be selecting it. And really importantly, you want to be talking to the people that manage or direct that place to see if it's all right to do some observational studies there. And I gave you some pointers. You want to assure people that you are not going to be talking, you're just going to be watching people, and that this is not, you're not going to be sharing this information. It's a class assignment. So anyway, that's where you can begin. And by the way, I'm sort of telling you, like this week you could choose the place. But if you want to begin designing your study also, don't. The sooner you begin working on the project, the better. Next week, you're really going to begin framing your problem. And again, this can so much build on what you've done for your observational study this past module. Maybe you got interested in, the benefit of this afternoon, parent-child interaction, which Scott's going to be telling us a little bit about. That could be an area of focus that you want to look at and try to understand. Maybe some of you got interested in gender and you want to do some sort of study that looks at gender. At any rate, you want to begin thinking about that. And so that will bring you to the end of Module 3. Module 4 begins on Tuesday, February 17th. And you really want to begin designing your study if you've not done so already. You want to figure out, you know, you've already figured out what your problem was. You want to begin looking at literature to see what kind of literature, what's out there. You want to think about what are the questions that I want to ask? What is the problem? For example, if you are interested in parent-child interactions, we can throw gender in there too. You might have an interest in seeing if you feel like maybe adults who are men, do they interact with children differently than adults who are women? And you could set yourself up. You could look at the literature for about that. And then you want to figure out the methods for your study. I mean, where are you going to collect your data? Who are you going to observe? How will you collect the data? And even at this stage, think a little bit about how you want to analyze it. And we're actually, the assignment, as I said, for Module 4 is to submit an outline of what you're thinking about doing. And if you can turn that in, I mean, of course, it's due the last Monday of Module 4, the 8th week, but if you can get it in sooner, we will be giving you feedback on your idea, which can then really help you as you carry out the study. You'll see in Module 5, we have a few sort of extra special readings, but the big focus of Module 5, both weeks 9 and 10, are about gathering and analyzing your data and writing it up. And so we're giving you 2 full weeks where you're not having to do another assignment or do anything extra beyond your final report. And I'll just highlight that the 5th and final radio show for this course will be on Tuesday, March 3rd, which is the first day of Module 5. And the whole radio show, we won't have a special guest. The whole radio show will be devoted to answering any questions you might have about your final project. And then in week 10, asking you to post your completed project write-up to the Module 5 discussion forum by Tuesday, March 17th. And I'm asking that because grades are due the following Monday by noon, so that'll give me time to actually read them and figure out your grade. If circumstances come up that are going to prevent you from finishing your project on time, please let me know very early, and we can try to make another arrangement. If we don't, if either Lena or I don't hear from you, and I perhaps for Michelle, you know, it's really going to, you know, we want to hear from you if you think there are going to be challenges. And the discussion forum assignment for that week is actually to critique and reflect upon 2 other studies that colleagues in the course conducted. And then there's a journal reflection that you'll do as well. So that's a real quick overview. Please feel free to ask questions begin. You can send emails either within Blackboard or directly to me or to Lena. You can copy both of us on those emails, and we can begin talking to you about your projects. In fact, I've already done that with some of you. So anyway, I just wanted to highlight the timeline. And I'm going to shift now into a very special guest that I'm delighted to welcome. Although I did want to say, Lena, Michelle, both of you took this course. Do you have anything to add about the final project? Oh, and Pat, you took this course too. Anything to say about the final project?
I don't know. Can you hear me?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, okay.
I can hear you.
Lena. Oh, okay. When I did the final project, I was very interested in gender, and I wanted to do it at the Children's Museum. And I think one of the things that I would recommend is seeing if you can hang out at the place where you want to do your study before you actually do your observational study to see if there's, you know, what kind of thoughts are triggered. to, you know, if you watch the interactions between people beforehand, then you can get a better idea as to maybe what kind of research that you want to do. I mean, you might already have your own ideas, but sometimes certain environments afford different kinds of interactions.
Yep.
That would be my advice so far. I can certainly talk about my project at another time when it's worthwhile or at the end of this program. But that's a good place to start.
Yeah, and I think that's in the description. I sort of whipped through, but it's a point very well taken. And I would say it's not too soon to try to make sure that the institution or organization is willing to have you sitting there watching people too. So.
Oh, definitely, because at the Children's Museum, they don't allow anyone without a child to be in there. So.
Oh boy! So you really
get special
permission.
They're kind of like, we're gonna walk around with you for your first time to kind of get your bearings, because we really just don't let random people just come to the Children's Museum. It's like, okay.
Yeah. And you could have walked on your knees, but you still have an adult-sized head, right?
right.
Anything, Michelle or Scott?
You know, I took this course quite a while ago. I think the final project has been redone and reformulated since I took it. But I have to say, going back two things, I said it in my course introduction to what you're saying just generally about the course, that it is a really challenging course. But I told all of my students at the beginning that this was probably the most rewarding, because it was the one that really made me think outside of the box that I was used to thinking in. It really pushed my thinking, and I think that was the rewarding part of this course. And then along those same lines, the kind of tools that you're learning and developing in this class, Liz and I were kind of talking about this before we went live, just learning how to observe and draw conclusions, how to write notes about what people are actually doing. That is a skill that you will continue to use time and time again.
Oh, and
that's, I think,
great.
It's really just important to learn and develop that skill, because it's been incredibly useful for, I think, every project I have worked on.
Oh, that's great. Yeah, you know, I was sending a note to the class yesterday, and I said, you know, a lot of times students feel like, oh, my goodness, you know, I'm not understanding these concepts real deeply. Some of my colleagues in class seem to really understand this, but I've said that often when I see students later or have them in another class, or they're working on their, you know, their capstone project, they'll actually say, you know, I reread Wirch, or I reread, you know, Lave and Wenger, and all of a sudden I realized I really understand it. So I think it's very layered, and as you learn more and take that observational lens with you out into the world, you know, you never quite see things the same again. So, you know, when I'm at restaurants, I always feel like I'm sitting there trying to figure out, what are those people doing and what are they talking about? So I'm such a great person to have in when you're dining out for a romantic evening. Do you mind if I sit with you and listen to your conversation? No, I would not do that. So.
I think a lot of us are on that same path, though, Lynn. It's hard to turn off.
Yeah. Well, I am really delighted to welcome a special guest this afternoon, at least my afternoon, Dr. Scott Pattison, and he is going to be talking about families and some interests he has related to families. I'm not going to spend a lot of time introducing him because I sent you his background, but actually, Scott, all of our students are really, really interested in sort of how people got to where they are, and mm-hmm. how they, at least at the moment, are what trajectory they feel they're on. And I've told all of the students what's really wonderful about your participation today, besides the great information you have to share, is that you actually were both a master's student and a doctoral student in the Free Choice Learning program. So I thought maybe you could start by introducing yourself a bit and maybe share with the class sort of, I think you have an interesting pathway, even through OMSI, in terms of where you began and then where you are now and what your future plans are, too.
Sure. So I'll throw out some things, and Lynn, just let me know if there's other things you want me to talk about. But
okay.
I work at OMSI. I'm a researcher and evaluator here in their department that includes both exhibit and program development and research and evaluation. I also work at the Institute for Learning Innovation with Lynn. And then until recently, my third job was getting a doctorate with Lynn. So we were spending more time.
That was a tough job.
It was a real tough job.
He's a very difficult boss, I understand.
But I definitely didn't start, you know, work at OMSI with any idea that this is where I would land. I got an environmental science degree, my bachelor of science from the University of Oregon, and I moved up to Portland with my girlfriend at the time, my wife now, just sort of with an idea that I don't have anything better to do. I'm going to move up with Kelly to Portland. And there was a guy I'd met actually at the Natural History Museum at University of Oregon who said he could get me a job working at the front desk at OMSI, which seemed like vaguely related to things I'd been doing. So that seemed better than, you know, working at McDonald's or something like that. So I spent about a year and a half working at the front desk at OMSI, which, you know, was great for someone who loved science. But I was looking for something different, and the first thing opportunity that appeared was to work as a museum educator on the floor. So I started working on the floor, working with visitors, working with families, working with school groups, developing some programs, which was great, and it was a great sort of hands-on introduction to what informal learning looks like and what museum learning looks like. But I was also interested in getting a little deeper into, you know, the museum, the behind-the-stage work, and so then an opportunity opened up to become an exhibit developer. So after a couple years, I became an exhibit and program developer. And the nice thing about that is then I actually had time on projects to do things like read books by John and Lynn and and sort of discover that there is a profession out there of people who think about this, whereas before when you're a museum educator, you feel like you're sort of alone. You're not quite sure what's guiding you. And at that point, you know, after a couple years working there, I really thought, well, I need to professionalize myself a little more. You know, what's the theory and research behind this work that I'm doing? So I entered the master's program, but it really was with the idea that, you know, 2 years I'd be done and I would be a better exhibit developer and program developer for having gone through that process. But of course, you know, Lynn, you guys have infused all this evaluation and research into the program, which is great, and I definitely got the bug. So before I was done with that program, I decided that I wanted to try my hand at research and actually go to the doctorate program. And at the same time, you know, again, it was nice that OMSI had all these opportunities. There was an opening in the evaluation department. So I switched to evaluation at OMSI and started the doctoral program. And that led me down this path of becoming a researcher. And it's interesting. I mean, the last thing I'd say about career pathways is there are definitely people in my department who love evaluation, and that's their big focus, and they love museums, and that's their big focus, and those are a big part of my life. But at some point I got really hooked on STEM education and STEM research, which is in some ways kind of a whole learning and education research is a whole separate but related area of work that's tied to evaluation, but it's not always the same thing. So at OMSI, I'm one of the people who lead a lot of the educational research projects, where a lot of my colleagues will do more program and exhibit development and exhibit evaluation work.
Interesting. I don't want to put you on the spot, but this might be an interesting. Could you briefly say what you feel the difference is between you know, this educational research that you're involved in, and then people on the staff that are doing more evaluation. You don't have to get into it in great detail, but I think that would be an interesting difference for, you know, for people in both the certificate program and in the master's program to hear from someone who lives and breathes it every day.
Yeah, well, I mean, there's obviously so much overlap and so much overlap in terms of the techniques that you use, but, you know, what I really realize is there is a whole literature out there on how you do quality evaluation and how you connect with these program and exhibit leaders and how do you support them and how do you help them achieve their goals, which is, you know, a huge skill set in itself. At the same time, you know, if learning education research, there's a whole literature about the kind of content you need to know and the kind of questions that are at the cutting edge and what we already know, which sort of leads you down another path in terms of what you're building on and the type of ways you're trying to innovate. And so you can just see that division within our department of who reads a lot of the evaluation literature versus who reads a lot of the science ed or science learning research literature and what things they're passionate about.
That's really interesting. And I think, too, when I think about the work that I know you're doing in research, you're trying to really expand knowledge in the field and trying to contribute to understanding. And that's not to say that evaluation can't do that. But often evaluation, you're just trying to figure out if a particular program or a particular exhibition is sort of accomplishing the goals set out to accomplish versus really trying to expand understanding that could be used by the whole field. Would you sort of agree with that?
Oh, yeah, certainly. And it's been interesting. When evaluation, we often, you know, we often partner with people who are already doing a program or exhibit or a writing proposal, whereas on the research side, it's often us who are writing the proposals ourselves with, like you're saying, the goal in mind of what is the knowledge we want to build for the field and how is this project going to do that.
Oh, that's interesting. Yeah. Well, we can, if students are interested in that, some of those distinctions, you know, they're welcome to call in. I'm going to remind people, and then we'll get into you talking about your master's work, Scott, but do remember, we'd love to have people call in, and you can call in about the final project if you want to talk in more detail about that, but if any of the things that Scott said about his career path, anything that Lena or Michelle said about the final project sort of gets you thinking even beyond the assignment, but thinking about the ideas of social science, which is really what we're trying to introduce you to, please feel comfortable calling in. The call-in number is 347-202-0449. So anyway, Scott, I'm really interested in you talking a little bit about your master's. I think I shared with you that a couple of our students are interested in families in museums, and they were sort of commenting that there seemed to have been a lot of work done in the, you know, actually 70s, 80s, and 90s, and not so much recent work. And I shared with them, well, some people are doing recent work, but also that I think there's been this idea, you know, that, wow, we need to understand families before they come to our institution. But you sort of, I'd love to hear how you talk about your work, because you started inside OMSI, and then for your doctorate, even though your families did visit OMSI, it was, a fairly small part of your doctoral work. So tell us a little bit about your master's.
Yeah, sure. And I feel like it's like you're saying, it's a little bit of a tale of just my mind being broadened. The longer I've been in the field, just realizing there's bigger issues out there that we're all tackling. So when I started my master's project, I mean, a couple of things that were motivating me. One, that I had been a floor educator at OMSI, and I was just fascinated with the fact that when you're in that position, there's not always that much to guide you. There's not that much research out there telling you what strategies are effective, what's not, how do you engage with families. And then also this idea that we talk a lot about the work that classroom teachers do, but when we were out in the halls or in labs, there was just something so unique and different about that that I kind of had this gut sense that everything we learned in a classroom wasn't always applicable, or there were things we could learn in the museum that could actually support the classroom and not the other way around. And so when I took this class, which blew my mind the way a lot of you guys talked about, it was such a fresh perspective on this interaction between museum educators and families or visitor groups, because instead of talking about it in terms of content or in terms of maybe a classroom instruction perspective, it was really about what are the social and cultural dynamics going on when you have some weird person in a purple vest walk up to a family in kind of this strange setting where you have bizarre contraptions around you and no one's quite sure what to do. And so I was, when I took this class, I became fascinated with the idea of what are the social dynamics going on in those situations. And the final project for this class actually became the pilot study for my master's research, where I spent several days videotaping what Lynn and I ended up calling unstructured interactions between family groups and staff, both volunteered and paid, at OMSI, and watching and carefully coding and sort of dissecting what happens, again, when a stranger walks up to the family group and what are the social dynamics that lead to either an educator being accepted and becoming an important part of that learning context, or the family putting off social signals that they're doing just fine by themselves and they'd rather not this weird person bother them right now.
And I had forgotten that was your pilot project in this course. That's great.
Yeah.
Of course, you didn't do the videotaping and stuff like that, right? Because it was an observational study. So,
well, for some reason I did. And I vaguely remember that my wife was really mad because we had a weekend to analyze it, and I had 4 hours of videotape, and so we were at the coast, and instead of hanging out with her, I was sitting in front of my laptop. But I don't know why I chose to do that.
Okay. That's probably in our new and refined program. We wouldn't expect that, and in fact, we won't worry about it.
Okay.
But anyway, moving on. So how did you end up? You know, one of the things that I was talking about. So you had this interest in staff and families, but now you have to figure out, well, how am I going to design a study that will help me tease that out? So how did you think about where to collect your data and so forth?
Yeah, well, there were lots of things that were sort of pushing me in one direction or the other. I mean, one thing was that there wasn't and still isn't a lot of research on museum educators, especially when you think about museum educators interacting in these sort of unstructured or casual interactions rather than, for example, a stage demo or a classroom program. And so whatever I did, I wanted it to be open-ended and that I could see a lot of the complexity and from that complexity try to see emergent themes or ways we could start talking about that we didn't have before. So that suggested a certain approach to it. It's mm-hmm. also, there was also this, always you have the issue of where's a place, a way of collecting data that is going to be naturalistic, if that's what you're interested in, but also you're not going to have to sit there for 2 years until you find something that's interesting and worth studying. So there were these places in OMSI that were specifically designed to have educators more present, and yet there were still places where visitors walked in and didn't necessarily have strong expectations about interacting with an educator or how long that interaction would be or what it would feel like. So these labs, as they're called at OMSI, were sort of a perfect place where I could be assured that I would see these type of rich interactions between families and educators, but they would still be somewhat unstructured. They wouldn't be, again, a demo or a classroom program. And then, actually, Lynn, you and I had several conversations about, you know, we knew it couldn't be the end-all, be-all study where I saw everything, but I wanted a little bit of variety in terms of context and type of interaction, so that I ended up making us choose two key laboratories that were somewhat different in their physical design and the way they approached the content that would give us a nice comparison if we videotaped in both spaces.
Oh, wow. So what did you find out?
Well, so long ago. again,
and I think
was,
I told you I did send the two papers that resulted from that study. I posted them for students. They may not have had a chance to read them because it was I just opened the module up yesterday. But
okay, great. Well, at a very brief level then, and, you know, there's more detail in there, obviously, but we had two sort of themes or sets of findings in three categories. I mean, one was just this idea that I was trying to distinguish what are the important phases of these interactions. If, again, you look at it from a social perspective and seeing that there's this phase where educators just have to initiate. They just have to become part of that group or try to become that, and that was fascinating. And then there was this phase where you saw educators trying to facilitate alongside family groups and what were the social dynamics going on there. And then you saw these phases where an educator would often try to introduce a new learning goal or a different task they wanted families to engage in, which sort of threw in a whole new set of interesting social dynamics. So just describing those phases was an important outcome of the study, but also seeing in those phases the roles that adults played became an important finding where, you know, and this has really stuck with me through all my work, you can't think of a family group as just a homogenous group. You know, kids have a very different role as parents or adults, and each adult or each family member often has very different roles or goals, and so especially watching how the adults would interact with the educators and the strong ways that adult family members were already facilitating learning within the family group became an important finding. And then finally, watching how, depending on the physical context, and I guess this is a different one of the series of these introductory courses, but watching how the physical context and the social context would actually influence the nature of the interactions between the educators and the family groups was very fascinating.
Oh, that really does sound interesting. And I just want to remind people that if you have any questions, please call in. The number is 347-202-0449. Actually, all of our students are working in some kind of free choice learning institution or organization, Scott. So, you know, I'm sure this is really, really relevant to them. So, you know, it's great that you did this research, but I know that you are very committed to influencing, practice and what people actually, do. And you commented that as a facilitator, you wished there was information that would help you, be a better one. I mean, what were some takeaways that you've thought were important to share with practitioners, and how have you figured out how to share the work with practitioners?
Yeah, you know, it resonated with me as with my educator hat on, and so I think it's something, some of these lessons I've really tried to share with others. One of the big ones was just, you know, appreciating what a family is, that the complex social dynamics that a family are, and facilitating with that in mind rather than, again, just taking straight from the classroom literature and assuming that when you walk up to a family, you're walking up to a captive audience of fifth graders, and that's the exact same thing. And actually, that and appreciating the uniqueness of being a wandering educator and walking up to a family and how you have to have a whole different set of skills to be able to navigate those social dynamics and then support family learning in a way that's a little bit different than you just saying, this is the goal we're now going to have. But you have to appreciate the family has their own goals, they have their own roles, and all that has to be acknowledged if you hope to be an authentic part of that learning. And so just those philosophical perspectives on educating in a museum have translated directly into some projects that were spinoffs of this work. So at the same time as we were working on the master's, actually, Lynn and I, again, were working on this project called Design Zone, where they were trying to create an exhibit to engage people in mathematics. And one of the ideas around that was, well, we always have educators in our halls, but we never design exhibits to support their role, so maybe we should do that. And if we did that, what would we think of, how would we think of that role, and how would we provide professional development for them? So this philosophy around authentically engage and responsively engaging the families became sort of the centerpiece of that professional development, and that's continued on. And actually, the educators really responded to that and provided a lot of input. And then that spawned a new project that we're working on now called Reveal. And I think the best thing about that project is not only were we giving findings to educators or doing research on educators, but we designed it so the educators were actually a part of the research team, and we've been trying to improve our understanding of effective facilitation strategies with them over the course of the project.
That sounds really, really exciting. So, well, I recall, you know, projects always have their little hiccups. You had quite a hiccup at the end of your master's because someone that we thought could be on your committee, it turned out, couldn't be on your committee, and we were scrambling around at the end to try to find someone in the sociology department who would be willing to be on your committee. And I always think that that was a really, first of all, she was wonderful coming in at the end, and she was very, very diligent. But she, I think she also sort of made you think a little bit about something really related to what this new module is about, around social stratification. So she was someone who'd done a lot of research with actually people who were incarcerated, and she also was really interested in issues around race, ethnicity, and class. And I remember her asking you towards the end of your defense about, you know, I'm trying to think if a working-class family came into the museum, would they feel as comfortable pushing back on the educator as some of the families did in your study? Do you remember that?
Oh, distinctly.
Yeah. Yeah. And I, you know, it's funny. I know you had many reasons for wanting to take your study outside, but I always remember because actually neither you nor I, if I recall, you know, we were scrambling around a bit, blah, 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 blah. And anyway, tell us what led you from that experience to a doctorate that is quite unique for many people who work in museums or science centers.
Yeah, well, I think the mark of a successful study, at least for the researcher, is that it presents a lot of really intriguing, motivating questions for your next project. So I felt like that was a success in that way, and that, you know, my the new committee member that I had, Michelle, who came in at the end, she you know, in a really interesting way, not criticism, but really pushing our thinking in terms of would we see the same type of social dynamics with different families. And for me, that broadened my thinking in terms of, yes, you know, what would other families do? But not only that, but why am I so focused on just studying families that are the usual suspects coming to this museum? Why am I so museum-focused or museum-centered rather than family-centered? And I was also very inspired by, I went in to study the dynamics between the educator and the families, but I was just as much intrigued by what I saw in the data about how the adults were engaging with their children and sort of the beautiful and interesting ways that adults have engaging with their children and the way that the adults navigated those social dynamics with the educator. And so the combination of those two made me think about for my dissertation, you know, is it better to think about start where the family is and think about all the context that they learn and engage in, one of which is very rich, which is the museum. So, but don't start in the museum. Start with the family and follow them to different contexts. So that was one decision that I pursued. The other thing was is to really question this idea of just sticking with the usual subjects, the usual folks at the museum, and thinking, well, who do we really want to support in learning and free choice learning and informal STEM learning? Who are the folks who have, like you were saying at the beginning, Lynn, have less power in certain situations, have less privilege in some of these you know, these STEM education systems that we've developed. And that, you know, as part of related to the Synergies project, kind of motivated me to reach out into the community and find a community partner that was already engaging with underserved groups and start with them in terms of recruitment. And I would say the last thing was, again, just becoming fascinated with that parent-child dynamic and really appreciating that parents do an amazing thing in a way that has probably a much longer-term impact than anything we can do as museum educators. So maybe the first thing we need to do is understand that in depth, and then we can learn how we can best support that rather than coming at the perspective that when a family comes, it's just our job to really fix any problems the parents have created and not appreciate what they're bringing.
Yeah, we'll fix them, right?
Yeah, exactly.
So anyway, so who did you end up working with in your study?
Well, at the same time I was sort of pushing myself age group-wise down, I was becoming fascinated with early childhood, and Lynn, you and the other folks of the Synergies Project had a good connection with the Mount Hood Community College Head Start program, and that actually ended up being a wonderful partnership because they really have an authentic relationship with the families and have trust with them. And so when I came to them and said, you know, I'd like to understand families, I'd like to go to their homes, I'd like to see how they interact with their kids, I'd like to invite them to come to the museum and see how they interact with their kids there, they were really able to say, great, we can help, you know, bridge that relationship and give the families trust for what you want to do. And so I ended up first doing a large survey by going to parent meetings and doing a survey with about 120 parents that were coming to these parent meetings, and then tried to select eight, ended up getting seven mothers and their four-year-old daughters, and we followed them for about 2 months, videotaping them about six times each.
Wow. So what were you trying to understand in the in your survey?
For the surveys, I mean, the bigger goal of the project was really to understand how, you know, young children with their parents start developing interests in science-related topics at this early age. And so the survey was supposed to serve a couple goals, which it did to varying degrees of success. But one goal was just to give us a lay of the land of, just to start out, what do parents believe about being a parent, and what are their interests in science? Because the idea is parents have such strong influence on their kids. Could we understand a little better what parents' interests are around science so that when we see them with their kid, we could see how that carries over or how they choose to support science interests or not? So we were able to get a little bit of a lay of the land that way. And then the other idea, which I hope we can more successfully use this in future projects, is we wanted to use that as a recruitment tool to get a subset of families to study in depth, because we wanted to be able to have that broader sample of data that we could then relate to the subgroup of folks we were following in detail. And interestingly enough, speaking of, you know, different cultural groups, one of the reasons that it didn't work very well is the vast majority of folks who said they were interested in participating in the follow-up all spoke Spanish in the home. And since I was going to be analyzing the data and I'm not bicultural, bilingual, it wasn't appropriate for me to be trying to analyze that data. But in the future projects, we hope to have bicultural, bilingual researchers who can go out and recruit and work with these families and analyze the data in Spanish from the home visits.
Oh, that's exciting. So, again, you had these interests, but you had to design something so that you would be able to understand at some level what was going on. How did you set up your study?
Well, you know, thinking about the second phase in particular, which was the in-depth qualitative study, you know, again, I had the situation where early childhood science interest was an area that had been researched a little bit, but not extensively. So it was more about hypothesis generation than it was about testing hypotheses. We really wanted to see what's going on here and what things do we want to study in the future. So that led us to a design that was more about smaller but more in-depth look at these folks. And another thing that was really driving that, Because, you know, I should say to your question, Lynn, what we ended up doing is we ended up setting up these four different situations where we asked families to, hey, we'll bring something to you or we'll ask you to participate in something, and then we'll videotaping you doing that with your child. For example, visiting OMSI, doing a science activity kit at home, reading a science-related book at home, or doing something that they felt was related to science, like taking a walk in a garden. So we had these situations, and we also interviewed the parents twice through that. And the idea is a lot of research has been done about what parents believe or some of these bigger, what they call distal factors that might influence child development, but people haven't really taken the time to look closely at what's going on between the child and the parent in the moment. So again, we needed some in-depth video data that would actually allow us to see and tease apart what is the parent saying, how is the child responding, what's the child doing. And we also needed to look at it over time because we were interested in interest development. So we wanted to see how something that happened in one moment might carry over, how a kid gets fascinated in turtles and then keeps talking to their parents about turtles. So this combination of close, in-depth looks of the interactions in the moment and then doing that many times over a period of 2 or 3 months so we could see even these short-term interest stories develop.
Wow. So, I'm realizing, if you guys, that's Lena and Michelle, have questions, by all means, don't feel like you can't ask a question, too.
Well, true. I do have some questions myself, but Amber did post some questions for Scott.
Oh, that's great.
Well, she, it kind of sounds like she's wondering about, the Free Choice Learning Institutions, especially the one that you're working at, OMSI, is embracing, the need for more rigorous education and visitor impact evaluation and research in your organization. And so she's wondering what was the path that led OMSI to establishing its own internal evaluation and visitor studies division.
Yes. Well, it's a funny question because I think it's an ongoing conversation. I mean, as soon as I feel like we have widespread buy-in for that within this institution, there's hundreds of people that work at OMSI, so it's a big lumbering thing. Then I turn around and something happens where it's like, oh, maybe we don't all have a shared idea of that. But sure that's true for any institution. But OMSI has had a small evaluation department for a long time. And what happened is they had someone who was mostly helping out with prototyping. So OMSI's always been a place that's been known for building exhibits and high-quality exhibits, and so testing those exhibits was always an important part. So they always wanted to have someone who's prototyping the exhibits. And then the big shift happened because of the National Science Foundation when they started coming out with, in their informal science education, now called ISIL, Advancing Science, Informal Science Learning, in that division, and people who were writing to that RFP, they were basically saying, okay, well, it was fine. You were developing fine exhibits before, but now it really needs to be about impact. So you need to define your impact well, and it really needs to be rigorously evaluated so that you show what the evidence is of that impact. And, that sent places like OMSI reeling for many years, just even thinking that way and having the capacity to do that kind of work. But out of that, we got a series of NSF grants that just multiplied the amount of people we had working on evaluation and research here by many times, and that has continued. And so there's sort of this chicken and egg thing where I think NSF saw the value of it first, and then as the capacity got built here at OMSI, you started to see the value. And that's happened again recently when NSF started pushing not just evaluation but educational research to be an important part of their ISIL grants. And I would say OMSI is still in the adaptation stage of trying to figure out what that means for how we do our work.
Interesting. Yeah.
Yeah.
So we don't have a were you going to say something more?
Oh, no.
I was going to she has one more question that she was kind of wondering about, something about how are you able to establish an effective and appropriate IRB status approval process? when your visitors are so diverse and stuff like that. I don't know if that's within this scope right now or not. But that was just one question.
Quickly to that, Lynn,
yeah,
or if you want
to talk a little bit about that, Scott, but I realize we didn't actually say what you learned from your doctorate.
Okay.
So
okay.
We've got about 5 minutes left. So if you can quickly talk about the IRB and say what you found out, and we could take another question if someone wants to call in, 347-202-0449.
So just
okay,
very
Scott,
quickly,
take it.
Yeah. So the IRB, you know, I think that's always something that's a challenge with any research project. What's been interesting is when you work at the university, you work with the university IRB. And so Oregon State University, you know, I think, Lynn, you were really helpful in making sure that I was in contact with those people and asking questions very early so that it became a dialogue about what would be effective for the research and would be appropriate and ethical with the people.
Yep.
And I will also say, though, that once you're outside the university setting, there are many types of IRBs that you can work with, and some really understand the type of work we do and others don't because they primarily work with medical researchers. And so finding the right IRB that's there to protect the participants but also understands the type of work you do and the level of risk has been an important process.
Yep, that's great. And I can just quickly say that this will become an issue as students in the course begin thinking about their capstones. And we've now offered two kinds of projects. One is a two-term project, which actually does not require getting IRB, and it's more like a final project on steroids. And then for students who are interested in doing this more research-focused work, they take the three-term IRB, three-term project, capstone project, and then they do need to get an IRB. So not all of you will need to worry about IRB, which is, by the way, Institutional Review Board, but for those people who are interested in research, they'll definitely need to do that. So anyway, Scott, what did you find out from these families?
Yes, well, a couple things, again, briefly. Hopefully we'll be publishing soon. But one thing we found is that, indeed, for every single family, we saw evidence of long-term interest developing in the kids, and we started these young children, and we started to see different types of interest stories, the way kids were either, you know, just becoming interested, very focused on the materials or the topics they've been presented, or we were watching these interests sort of blossom out into broader topics or areas. So it was fascinating to document what that looks like in early childhood. And then we started to see these patterns where certain families and certain ways that parents interacted with their children seemed to lead the children down certain types of interest pathways rather than others. For example, you know, things you might expect, but lots of positive affect from the parent or positive emotional response for the parent while engaging in science-related activities with kids seemed to be a strong motivator for kids to stay interested or return to that topic. And also very interesting, we seem to find examples, evidence where the way the parents were able to reflect on themselves as learners and think about things like, oh, wow, my kid is in this stage and they're interested in this, and that means that I, as a parent, might want to think about how I do this differently or think about the type of opportunities I provide. That kind of reflective orientation also seemed to motivate them to respond to their children in different ways. And so from this very small sample, we essentially developed kind of this reciprocal model of parents and kids feeding into interest development that has a lot of hypotheses embedded in it. And I think next step, which I'm really excited about, is to try to test some of those in a broader sample and see which ones really hold up and which ones were very much more unique to the group that we worked with.
That's great. And I understand that Head Start's really interested also in you sharing what you found out.
Yes, actually, I was just exchanging some emails last week where they want me to come to their Head Start leaders and share some of that and engage in a discussion with them about what this might mean for the work that they do, and especially they're thinking more about supporting science learning because they have a lot of pressure to do that as a Head Start program. I just can't say enough about the value of working with a good community partner because, again, they have the relationships that it's just impossible to have when you're a researcher swooping in and doing this kind of work.
Yeah, I mean, they really worked alongside you, I always felt.
Yes.
They helped with translating your surveys, both language-wise and culturally. Mm-hmm. So, well, we're going to end off in a moment. We're going to get cut off. Thank you so much, Scott, and thanks to
Lynn.
Lena and Michelle, too.
Thank you.
And the people, you can follow up with me, and we'll put you in touch with Scott.
Great.
Wonderful.
Okay, we're done now. We're off.
Okay.
All right.
All right, take care.
Give us all these, she used to do all these cues.
Do you still have a second, Scott?
I do. Do you want me to stay on this line? Can I stay on this line?
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
Oh, okay. Well, what I am trying to attempt to do for my capstone project, and I'm still wrestling around with these ideas because I was thinking I was going to do something else, and now I decided to come up with this whole brand new idea, which now looking at back going, I don't know what I'm doing, but I am looking at the fact, I love STEM, and I think it's, you know, a wonderful push, but I don't know if other museums that are not science related are really embracing this so much, and I want our small museum to embrace it more.
Right.
And so I am trying to, we are going to be creating, I'm going to work with the educator to try to create her class field trip and infuse STEM in her class field trips. But what I was wondering if you knew, because you kind of mentioned that you're really getting into STEM and STEM research and learning and things like that.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, are there any particular resources that maybe I should be looking towards to create a well research-based field trip for kids at a, you know, it's a non-science museum, and we're going to try to infuse science in this curriculum.
Yeah, well, I mean, I think Lynn would be able to speak to this a lot more than I can, but just to say a few things, there's definitely a literature, a lot of it coming from science centers about field trips.
Okay.
So that's definitely out there.
Okay.
And, you know, it kind of goes back to what I was saying about the relationship between classrooms and informal or free choice learning. It's like, to what extent do you feel like the situation that you have there is mirroring things that go in the classroom? Because there's certainly sort of these high profile National Research Council publications on what are effective science education practices. And then, I mean, I'm sure you're aware of the learning science in, now I'm suddenly having a brain.
Oh, informal environment?
Yeah.
Yeah,
so
that
one.
Yeah.
Okay, so that one was the one that tried to synthesize a lot of the research on that work in that area. But, you know, the sad thing is, in terms of the actual educational practices in an informal setting, we're still a little bit thin. I don't know if you've looked on informalscience.org.
No.
That's supposed to be the big repository for a lot of this stuff, and they have a good search engine now called the Commons or the?
The Commons. Yep.
Yeah, so that'll search not only informalscience.org, but several other websites like Smile, nanoscience.org, and a couple other big websites that have tons of resources.
All right. I'm just kind of getting started in trying to find the right literature for this, and so I don't know. I'm still looking out there and then still trying and then looking at how, because this is a non-science type of museum, that we should probably respect the context of the museum and try to bring, you know, their history and art into the field trip program too, because, you know, that should be important. I mean, context is important as well. So
yeah,
I don't know. I'm just still...
Scott, I've been telling Lena about STEAM.
And at first,
I don't know if you know of any good examples of museums that are trying to that are maybe non-science. Although, you know, it might help to look at science museums trying to bring arts in, too.
Yeah. Well, you know, you just
got maybe, okay.
At the Aztec, Boston and the, what's it called, Lynn? You did the work with them with the Prairie... I'm having a memory.
Connor Prairie?
Connor Prairie is now doing a project where they have science demos in their history museum, and they're having lots of those interesting conversations about how do you stay true to their focus while bringing in STEM.
Oh, that sounds great. So is it an NSF grant, or?
I think so, and I think it's a partnership between Connor Prairie and the Museum of Science Boston.
Okay.
Would they have something that would have been published or already, or
if they're just starting? Are they just starting, Scott?
I think they're a couple years in, and knowing when I saw their presentation, it looked like they maybe had some slick at least website or handout. So I don't think they have any articles, but I think they might have some nice project descriptions that would be helpful.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, okay. So what would I look up again?
Well, I would look up. Go ahead.
No, I was just going to say I could give you some names of people at least Connor Prairie.
Okay.
Yeah, but or do you know who the person at Museum of Science is working on it, Scott?
I'm trying to remember. Anne Lindegrass Striken was telling me about it, but I don't think she's working on the project. So I would go with whatever contact you have, Lynn.
Okay. I'll do some research, because I would like to know about that too, Lena. And I'll send you some suggestions.
Okay. Yeah, that sounds great, because I've been, you know, I don't know. There's a lot of different ways when you start talking about, you know, STEAM and STEM and sticking it into... a non-science, and is it a good idea? You know, I don't know. So I'm still trying to find the right kinds of articles. So,
just contacted like a year ago about a master's student who I think was at John F. Kennedy, who was doing a survey of museums around the country and how they were integrating art into STEAM.
Uh-huh.
But if you nudged me or sent me an email, then that would be I could go see if I can track down that person and they sent me the thesis. I'd have to find it in my email.
That would be great. Lena, do you have Scott's email?
No, I don't. But that that would be great, because I didn't even think about that aspect that, you know, I've read a few articles about, you know, art and STEAM and why it's good, but I didn't even think about, you know, looking for, you know, established STEM places who are trying to incorporate arts, because then I could at least sort of look at it and go, okay, well, now I'm trying to do the reverse.
Yeah.
So, or
and
something
I think,
like that. I don't know.
Yeah, so if you email me, but the other thing is, I think, I don't know if you agree with this, Lynn, but I think children's museums do sometimes a better job than science centers navigating that, because they're thinking about early childhood and the connections between all these content areas. So I don't know if it would be worth looking at the Association of Children's Museums, looking at some of their past programs from their conference meetings or things like that.
Mm-hmm. That's a good idea.
Okay.
Yeah. So I'll send you Scott's email, Lena, so you can follow up and remind him about the JFK thesis, and then I'm already looking into the Connor Prairie Museum of Science project.
Great. Thanks.
Cool.
Thanks, guys.
Yeah, that's exciting.
Thanks. Thanks so much, John.
Yeah.
Okay, well, I'll talk to you guys later.
Okay,
thanks.
Bye.
Bye-bye.
Okay, take care.
Bye.
Bye.